This is Beverly Osband, November 4th, 1994, a lecture entitled Fate, Unfairness, and Jung's Answer to Job.
November 4, 1994, fall schedule, Gnosticism and Ancient and Modern series. Beverly Osband will give a lecture this evening, considering fate, unfairness, and Jung's answer to Job. In the realm of psychology, one rarely meets the concepts of fate and unfairness, except in Jung's work. Jung said of fate, all passion is a challenge to fate, and what it does cannot be undone. Fear of fate is a very understandable phenomenon, for it is incalculable, immeasurable, full of unknown dangers. Collected Works 5, paragraph 165. When we experience loss, we are confronted with a fate we do not desire. Our passion is thwarted, and we must grapple with uncertainty and fear as we try to move on. This evening, we will explore concepts of fate and unfairness, focusing on biblical story of Job, the answer to Job.
More details about fate and the issues of unfairness. I've always been told when I start a lecture that I should never start with an apology, so I always do. And the apology tonight has to do with the fact that in large measure I plan to read my presentation tonight because there are a number of quotes, and it's a fairly tightly woven presentation, and I don't want to lose track, and I certainly don't want to misquote. So I'll be doing that, although I won't keep my nose in the paper. To keep contact with all of you. I'd also like to acknowledge the help of three people in particular as I put this manuscript together and once it was finished. Kate Millard, Anne DeVore, and my husband Eberhard Riedel were all very kind and generous with their time. They read it, they gave me feedback, and helped me turn it into what you'll be hearing tonight. So I really appreciate their work. I'd just like to mention, too, before I start, that for those of you who have read Answer to Job, you already know just how stimulating and how sort of psychoactive this particular piece of Jung's writing is. And so as I talk about it tonight and as I talk about issues of fate, I think a lot will be coming up for people. And I hope that if you have questions that we don't get to tonight, you'll bring them tomorrow to the workshop. And certainly there'll be time after the lecture to have some discussion and questions after we have a break. So without further ado, I'll start. When I was 7 years old, I went to day camp at Genesee Valley Park in upstate New York. I was born and grew up in Rochester, New York. And one day we decided that we would have a carnival. And I decided that I would be the fortune teller. And so I scrounged up some old skirt and a blouse and tied a red scarf around my head. And I went digging into the bottom of my mother's jewelry box and found some dangling earrings that would be very fashionable today, but she would have never been seen in. And then I went to the basement and found an old fishbowl, which I turned upside down, and that became my crystal ball. And so at the carnival, all the kids lined up, and they became my clients. And I waved my hands kind of mysteriously over the fishbowl, and I said things like, "You will meet a tall, dark stranger." No, I was only 7 years old, right? "You'll travel to far-off lands, or you will be a famous movie star." Everyone said I told good fortunes. And they really liked it a lot. It was really fun, but it was also just a little bit spooky. I guess, though, I wasn't conscious of it at the time, that what we were all really playing with was this notion of fate and the future, the unknown and those feelings that come with the unknown, the excitement and the fear, the anticipation and the dread, the, "Oh, if only I knew," and the, "I can't stand it, I don't really want to face it." So this evening, as I already said, I'll be talking about Jung's answer to Job and the book of Job, and some about fate and unfairness, as forces which shape the way we feel about and deal with occurrences in our lives. And it's particularly when these occurrences bring us pain or bring us sorrow that we're forced to look at fate and ask questions about this force of fate that whispers in the night. When we confront these things, which we define as being evil or being hard in our lives, we invariably begin to ask questions about what kind of powers are at work in the world. Now, researching this topic of fate and unfairness or injustice was a real challenge. I found myself going to just a whole variety of areas, exploring philosophy, anthropology, theology, and the classics. Of course, I'm particularly interested in psychology, and so I also looked at psychology and psychiatry sources. But with the exception of several references to fate and destiny in the collected works of C.G. Jung, I was hard-pressed to find any mention of fate in the literature at all. There was one exception, and it was a 1984 volume of the Psychoanalytic Quarterly, and an article by the late Donald Kaplan entitled "Reflections on the Idea of Personal Fate and Its Psychopathology." Helene Deutsch's Hysterical Fate Neurosis Revisited. This was an intriguing title to me. There was one irresistible quote that I just couldn't leave out of tonight's talk, and I'd like to share that with you, so I'm quoting now. "Whatever fate used to signify from a psychoanalytic point of view, the concept has long since been assimilated by more systematic concepts, so that we no longer find it urgent to hold any opinions on the subject of fate. Thus, as a theme in a publication of a former epoch, it seems to us a curiosity, a provisional construct that was bound to succumb to a process of conceptual reorganization." End quote. So we can all just go home now and forget about that. But we won't. When I began this work, I became aware of fate as a phenomenon of human life with which I had been struggling on a personal level for some time. I realized that to write or to speak about it would be to work with something that I might never fully comprehend. But it was my desire to know this beast better that pulled me into this encounter. As the work has progressed and as I've gotten more involved in it, I've had some trepidations and wondered at times whether I was probing into something forbidden. Sometimes there were glitches along the way that clearly told me that I needed to tread carefully. For centuries, humankind has struggled to come to grips with the difficult questions about fate, justice, good, and evil. While most people generally agree that life is reasonably good and worth living, there are few who completely escape life's vicissitudes, times when things go badly, when there's loss, sometimes tragic loss, sometimes merely disappointing loss. When things go well, we may feel powerful, in charge of our lives, filled with a sense of freedom to determine our own destiny. And when modesty creeps in, we may temper those feelings with attributions to good luck, to God's help, to hard work, or to good timing, being in the right place at the right time. But when things go badly, when we suffer physical or emotional pain, we come to wonder just who is in charge. We ask questions like, why me? Is this my fate? Do I have the power to determine my own destiny, or am I just a plaything of the gods? The earliest recorded histories of questions about fate and free will date back to ancient times, to Mesopotamia and ancient Egypt, to the Greeks and to the Hebrews, whose stories and myths reflect their struggles with these issues. In his book, The Great Mother, Erich Neumann explores fate as a powerful feminine force, stating that, quote, "Fate is the sacred center of life. From its womb flow wealth or want, happiness and unhappiness, life and death." Now, among the mythological and legendary figures, few are as powerful as Job in evoking the sense of the human struggle inherent in the question, why me? In his essay, Job, Our Contemporary, Elie Wiesel says of Job, quote, "Through the problems he embodied and the trials he endured, he seems familiar, even contemporary." In times of stress, it's his words that we turn to express our anger, revolt, or resignation. He belongs to our most intimate landscape, the most vulnerable part of our past. Now, it's quite likely that in his writing, Wiesel was most directly referring to victims of the Holocaust, but I believe that he's also saying that the meaning of Job's experience resonates for all of us who have suffered unjustly. It is for these reasons that I've chosen to focus on the story of Job and on Jung's answer to Job as vehicles to explore the concepts of fate and unfairness. The book of Job is a well-known story dating probably from about the 7th century B.C. It's a story of a good and pious man, a man of, quote, perfect integrity who feared God and avoided evil. Job is also a very wealthy man. Now, the day came when the Lord and Satan were visiting. And Satan struck a wager with God, betting that if Job lost everything, he would curse God. And God agreed to the wager. And he said only, "Everything he has is in your power. Just don't lay a hand on him." Now, it's important to notice here that it was not originally God's idea to test Job. He was tricked into doing it by Satan. The result is that Job became a pawn in a game between two supernatural powers, who themselves, we can conjecture, were in the power of a fate greater than they. What feels particularly tragic about the story of Job is that he was, for all that we know of him, an innocent bystander who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and became a victim of heavenly politics. I'll be quoting some from the book of Job, and the translation that I've used and that I like very much is a recent translation by Stephen Mitchell, for those of you who might be interested in looking at it later. "So, when Satan's work is done, Job is bereft of all he possessed and held dear. But he does not curse the Lord. He says instead, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken. May the name of the Lord be blessed.'" He didn't curse God, as Satan predicted. But Satan wasn't satisfied. And so, at the next committee meeting, he and the Lord get together. And he says, "You know, he didn't curse you, but I think if you were to raise the stakes, if you were to strike his flesh and bones, he would curse you." And God said, "All right, he's in your hands. Just don't kill him." At once, Job is covered from head to foot with boils, and he sits in the dust, scratching himself with a bit of broken pottery. Now, as the story unfolds from this point, Job is forced to confront the reality of his misery. His wife and his friends raise doubts about his innocence, and Job comes not to curse God, but to curse himself instead. He says, "God damn the day I was born and the night that forced me from the womb. On that day, let there be darkness. Let it never have been created. Let it sink into the void." Job goes on to ask, "Why me?" He says, "Why couldn't I have died as they pulled me out of the dark?" Job's friends believe that God is just, and that Job must have sinned to be so punished. This is a reflection of the common philosophy at the time. It was a part of the wisdom movement, which held that if you were good, you were rewarded, and if you were bad or you sinned, you would be punished. And in fact, if something bad happened to you, that was proof that you had sinned because you were being punished, even if you couldn't imagine or identify or think of anything that you had done to transgress. Job defends himself mightily against these doubters, searching within and without for answers to his misfortune. Like the friends, he also believes that the good are rewarded and the evil are deprived. But he believes with all his heart that he has done no wrong. After Job hears his so-called friends out, he ends his statement with the following summation. If only God would hear me, state his case against me, let me read his indictment. I would carry it on my shoulder or wear it on my head like a crown. I would justify the least of my actions I would stand before him like a prince. Instead, Job is answered in a way that he could never have imagined. God comes to him as the voice from the whirlwind. In essence, God says, "Who do you think you are, questioning me?" And he begins his statement with these opening words. "Who is this whose ignorant words smear my design with darkness? Stand up now like a man. I will question you. Please instruct me." And what follows, for those of you who've read the book, you'll remember, is a long, long tirade in which God identifies all of the things that he's done, all of the extraordinary things that he's done, essentially saying to Job, "Could you have done any of this?" And so God begins to question Job about his understanding of God's might, power, and responsibility. Job is overwhelmed. Halfway through, the unnameable asks whether Job has given up, lost his tongue, and Job answers, "I am speechless. What can I answer? I put my hand on my mouth. I have already said too much. Now I will speak no more." Yet the voice continues, and Job is made to bear further witness to God's extraordinary power. When the voice has finished, Job responds, and for the first time, the reader is given the sense of a light dawning within Job, a light which reflects a quiet but new and growing awareness of who and what this omnipotent, omniscient being really is. Job says, "I know you can do all things, and nothing you wish is impossible. Who is this whose ignorant words cover my design in darkness? I have spoken the unspeakable and tried to grasp the infinite. Listen and I will speak. I will question you. Please instruct me. I have heard with my ears, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I will be quieted, comforted that I am dust." And so the story ends. Now the epilogue finds God rewarding Job and punishing the friends. Job is given children to replace the children who died. Now it's important that Job wasn't given back his children. He was given new children, replacement children. And all his wealth was returned in vast multiples. Job lived out his years and died finally at 140, a very great age. This powerful story has captured our attention and stirred our emotions for centuries. There is the universal sense of identifying with the victim, of knowing the feeling of being treated unjustly and unfairly. Mitchell, whose translation I've been using, suggests in his commentary that the story of Job is a parable of the post-Holocaust age. In this regard, perhaps, the most powerful commentary on the story, though, is Jung's answer to Job. I have the sense that, although Jung does not say so explicitly, that his answer to Job, which was written in 1952 and then translated into English in 1954, about 7 years after the end of World War II and the Holocaust, was a part of Jung's own effort to come to terms with the horrors of the war and of the Holocaust, and with his own brief seduction by the Nazis. In writing Answer to Job, Jung states that he was trying to come to terms with certain religious ideas and traditions, noting that in Ion he had dealt with some problems related to Christ as a symbolic figure in the antagonism between Christ and the Antichrist. However, in Answer to Job, Jung states that he is giving a much more explicit and consequently more inflammatory answer to questions about the image of God on which Judeo-Christian belief is based, and on the source or locus of evil in the world. While early Christians believed in a monotheistic God which ruled the world with the right hand, which symbolized Christ and the good, and the left hand, which symbolized Satan and evil, later Christianity was dualistic. Satan was split off into an eternal state of damnation, seen as a separate and powerful source of evil. Thus Jung struggles with the observation, quote, "If Christianity claims to be a monotheism, it becomes unavoidable to assume the opposites as being contained in God." Like Jung, I believe that this is precisely the awareness that comes to Job as he suffers the horrors of overwhelming loss and degradation. Jung begins his answer to Job with the observation that the book of Job was a landmark poem in the history of divine drama because it dealt so openly with the contradictory qualities of God. For Jung, the combined presence of insight along with obtuseness, loving kindness along with cruelty, creative power along with destructiveness could only be described as amoral. Jung is clear, however, that his response to Job's ordeals is a purely subjective one that comes from his concern about how, quote, a modern man with a Christian education and background comes to terms with the divine darkness which is unveiled in the book of Job. And Jung writes, I shall not give a cool and carefully considered exegesis that tries to be fair in every detail, but a purely subjective reaction. In this way, I hope to act as a voice for many who feel the same way I do, and to give expression to the shattering emotion which the unvarnished spectacle of divine savagery and ruthlessness produces in us. Jung's answer to Job is a lengthy and complicated essay, and tonight I'll really just be concentrating on the first two sections, dealing to a large extent with Jung's exploration of the psychology of the Old Testament God, a God who could enter into a bet with the devil, resulting in excruciating pain and suffering to a basically innocent man in order to prove his own power, and I think Jung would say to stroke his own ego. Jung notes that throughout the poem, Job struggles with the idea of meeting God on the basis of justice and morality. Jung suggests that Job finally comes to the awareness that he is, quote, up against a God who does not care a rat for any moral opinion and does not recognize any form of ethics as binding. For Job, the unity of God is real. Yahweh is not split, but an antinomy, a totality of inner opposites. For this reason, Job holds to the belief that he can find a helper in God against God, if only he can come before God and state his case. Jung goes on to explore Yahweh's motives for taking Satan's challenge and discusses the notion that man in his smallness and feebleness in fact possesses something Yahweh himself does not have. But what could that possibly be? Jung suggests that what man has is, quote, a somewhat keener consciousness based on self-reflection. He must, in order to survive, always be mindful of his impotence, end quote. Jung wonders whether the possession of what he calls an infinitely small and yet concentrated light is what stimulates Yahweh's jealousy and anger against Job. Now, I believe that it is this tiny but concentrated light lying behind Job's dawning awareness as he endures the voice from the whirlwind that illuminates the path of inner reflection as Job mulls over God's words and outwardly acquiesces to Yahweh's power. When Job speaks after the voice from the whirlwind, he seems to speak with two voices, one audible in which he speaks to God and one inaudible with which he speaks to himself. And I'll quote again the quote I read earlier. He says to God, I know you can do all things, and nothing you wish is impossible. And to himself he says, almost in a puzzled but searching tone, who is this whose ignorant words cover my design with darkness? And then again he speaks aloud, I have spoken of the unspeakable and tried to grasp the infinite. And then quietly again to himself, listen and I will speak. I will question you. Please instruct me. And again, aloud, I have heard with my ears, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I will be quiet, comforted that I am dust. I have the sense that Job is really questioning and seeing just who and what this God is. Jung suggests that the only darkening going on is being done by Yahweh when he made his wager with Satan. And I believe that Job is aware of this as well as the story ends. Jung points to the grotesque mismatch between Yahweh and Job as Yahweh goes on and on in the voice from the whirlwind, rhapsodizing his mighty power in passages that we know as this section, the voice from the whirlwind. Jung continues, noting that what adds to the acuity of the conflict is that through his suffering, Job has achieved a vantage point from which he can, in essence, behold the back of Yahweh, the abysmal world of the shards. The term shards refers to an idea that was found in Kabbalistic philosophy, which holds that they represent the forces of evil and darkness. At the beginning of the world, the light was caught in vessels called the Sephiroth. There were 10 of them. And some of the vessels were not able to contain the light, and so they broke. And the shards that were left when these vessels broke were thought to be what formed the container or the focus for evil in the world. And it was thought in some legends and stories that they became lodged in the back of God so that he himself couldn't see them though they were there. Jung suggests that from this experience, Job comes to the awareness that Yahweh is not human, but in certain respects, less than human. It's little wonder that Jung began his text with caveats and apologies for what he would write. His words are inflammatory. There's no doubt about that, given the mainstream notions about where evil resides in the universe and the goodness of God. Yet I believe that his thoughtful, if complex, analysis contains important seeds for anyone attempting to understand the experience of overwhelming loss. After Jung wrote Answer to Job, it was published, there was a tremendous outpouring of response, much of it extremely critical. People who had long supported and admired Jung wrote to him in horror at his the blasphemy of what he had written in Answer to Job. I think it's also interesting that toward the end of his life, when he was asked about his work and his writing, would he change things that he had written, he said that Answer to Job was the one piece of writing that he wouldn't change at all, while he would have edited or modified or changed many of his other works. There are other interpretations of Job's final words. There are those who suggest that they come from a place of surrender. Mitchell, whose translation I've been quoting from tonight, states that surrender is both the ultimate generosity and the ultimate poverty, because in it the giver becomes the gift. Mitchell concludes that Job has faced evil, has looked straight into its face, and through it into a vast wonder of love. I believe that Mitchell reveals a strong Christian orientation with this interpretation, drawing an unspoken parallel between Christ's suffering and sacrifice and Job's. By contrast, Elie Wiesel is troubled by what he calls Job's hasty abdication and by the epilogue to the book of Job as well. Wiesel prefers to think that the true ending of the book was lost, and rather than Job repenting in humiliation, that he died, quote, succumbing to his grief, an uncompromising whole man, end quote. Wiesel also entertains the notion, not entirely unlike Jung's, that when the voice from the whirlwind ceased, Job only pretended to abdicate, that his repentance was a decoy. If this is so, Wiesel argues, then, quote, Job personified man's eternal quest for justice and truth. He did not choose resignation. When I first read the story of Job, I felt a strong identification with this man who had feared God and avoided evil, yet who had been made to suffer unimaginable losses. I, too, had suffered losses that I never would have imagined and wondered what I had done to provoke such punishment. But as always, there were no answers. I was also very angry, enraged really, as I read the epilogue and learned how Job was given back all that he had lost and more. It seemed to me that even the ancient storytellers had a hard time dealing with the realities and the permanence of overwhelming loss. As I continue to grapple with this question in my own life and in my work as a therapist, I've come to the awareness that the answer, if there is any kind of answer, has to do with fate. from the limited vantage point of this present moment, there is no way for me to know how these past losses will weave together with present events and actions that are going on now, and with the unknowns of the future, to bring me finally, maybe only at my very last moment, to an understanding of what this life was all about. I believe that what happened to Job was clearly unfair and unjust. It seems it was his fate to have been chosen as the pawn in Satan's wager with God. And there are many stories in the Midrash and in other commentaries that argue about why it was Job who was chosen. It makes really fascinating reading. But I also agree with Jung when he says that it was God's fate to have been challenged by Satan. Jung says, "We do not know whether Job realizes this, but we do know from numerous commentaries on Job that all succeeding ages have overlooked the fact that that a kind of Moira or dyke rules over Yahweh, causing him to give himself so away so blatantly. In this sense, fate functions as an overarching potency, a kind of archetypal force that governs beings, human and otherwise, in some inexorable way. Perhaps just as the ancient Greeks portrayed the goddess Fate, Moira, as coming before and reigning over even Zeus, the ancient Hebrews too believed that even God, in all his omnipotence and omniscience, was subject to fate. Though Jung notes the difficulties of the ancients in dealing with such thoughts, stating, quote, "Even in those days, the critical intellect of a Greek could easily have seized on this new addition to Yahweh's biography and used it in his disfavor, so as to mete out to him the fate that had already overtaken the Greek gods. But a relativization of God was utterly unthinkable at that time and remained so for the next 2,000 years." That, it seems, is the nature of fate. It influences our lives in ways we cannot control, see, or comprehend. Even as we make decisions, enact our desires, strive for achievement, try to make ourselves happy, or even just content. Fate creates the shape or pattern within which we act towards some outcome, often unknown to us. This doesn't excuse our actions, but it may make them understandable in retrospect. And I think there are numerous examples in the Greek tragedies of people who were fated, who, in spite of their best efforts to avoid their fate, lived it out. And I think, you know, what comes to mind, I'm sure, for all of you is Oedipus. He did everything in his power not to kill his father or marry his mother, but that's precisely what happened. He couldn't escape it. The word fate comes from the Latin fatum, meaning prophetic declaration or oracle, and from fatus, meaning to speak. Moira, the Greek word meaning fate, and hymarmene, also defined as fate, derived from the verb stem myromi, which means to receive one's portion. From the poetry and tragic drama of the time, which was very similar to the time that Job was written, about 700 BC on up and towards, you know, 400, 300 BC, we know some things about the way early Greeks thought about Moira. Through their literature, it's clear that the Greeks were aware of the power and capriciousness of this natural force. Moira was a daimon of opposites, dispensing food and warmth, shelter, but also hardship and suffering, a force wonderful in variety, neither wholly good nor wholly evil. It seems the Greeks had an awareness that these opposites could be combined in a single force. They didn't have a problem with it. They may have had a problem with it, but they accepted it, or expected it. Throughout ancient world mythologies, the fates were almost invariably female figures, usually, though not always, three in number. They are described as the daughters of Nyx, the goddess of night, or Urda, the earth mother. They are the triple-faced Hecate, the Erinyes, and the Graiae. They are sometimes represented by the waxing full and waning moon, or by the three phases of a woman's life, maiden, wife, and crone. In Greek mythology, they were the spinners and weavers. There was Clotho, the eldest, who spun out the thread of life, Lachesis, who determined its length, and Atropos, who cut it off. Plato in the Republic writes, "And the whole spindle of the universe turns on the lap of necessity, and on top of each circle stands a siren, which is carried round with it and utters a note of constant pitch. And the eight notes together make up a single scale. And round about at equal distances sit three other figures, the three fates, the daughters of necessity, Lachesis, Clotho, and Atropos. And they sing the siren's music, Lachesis of things past, Clotho of things present, Atropos of things to come." Thus, for the Greeks, it was necessity and the fates which governed all, even the gods themselves. The Greeks believed that the fates were concerned with more than predestination in an everyday personal sense. Rather, they believed that the fates governed the natural order of the universe, the orderly pattern of beginning, growth, and ending. The work of the fates was often linked to the creation of a fabric. The metaphors of spinning and weaving, as we've already seen in the naming of the Moirai, are often used to describe their work. Liz Green, in her very interesting book, The Astrology of Fate, quotes from a second century Gnostic text as follows, "And so these two, fate and necessity, are bound to one another mutually, to inseparable cohesion. The former of them, Hymarmony, gives birth to the beginning of all things. Necessity compels the end of all, depending on these principles. On these does order follow. That is their warp and woof, and time's arrangement for perfection of all things. For there is naught without the interblend of order." I think this is just a beautiful kind of reflection of that sense of the way lives weave. And I think, you know, as we think about our own lives, we can almost sense that sense that way in which life is a fabric that's day by day woven to reflect the experiences that we have. Now, another word that's associated with this notion of fate is destiny. The Latin root of the word destiny means to stand apart. It comes from the Latin destinare, to fasten down, to secure, to determine, which in turn comes from the prefix de, meaning down or away, and stare, to stand. So destiny then can be considered that which makes one stand apart from others, that which one makes one unique. So that perhaps we can think of destiny having to do with fate at an individual level. Now, given the notion of individual fate, it's important to consider that besides the seemingly external forces which govern human life, there are also inner forces which govern our lives as well. Socrates and Plato describe a deterministic force in human affairs, which they call the daimon, a force which has an ambitious quality to it. The daimon is a dispenser of personal fate, which is what drives the individual from within to achieve his or her uniqueness. The effects of the daimon are often seen in terms of vocation, the response to being called to one's work, or other creative endeavors. I think that for Jung, the effects of the daimon are manifested in the development of the personality and in the process of individuation. In discussing the development of personality, Jung first notes that, quote, "many are called but few are chosen," and goes on to explore the inherent difficulties, stating that, quote, "it is at once a charisma and a curse, because the first fruit is the conscious, unavoidable segregation of the single individual from the undifferentiated and unconscious herd. It is unavoidable to follow one's destiny. It is unavoidable. To follow one's destiny means isolation. It means standing apart. And there's no comforting word for it. Jung observes that for modern men and women, the heroic lifestyle is also oriented by fateful decisions, and the decision to go on holds, sometimes to the bitter end. Jung goes on to note that even for the majority, quote, life is not a simple straight line. Fate confronts them like an intricate labyrinth, all too rich in possibilities, and only one is their own right way. Who would presume, even though armed with the completest knowledge of his own character, to designate in advance the single possibility? Much indeed can be attained by will, but in view of the fate of certain markedly strong-willed personalities, it is a fundamental error to try to subject our own fate at all costs to our will. Fate is paradoxical. It can manifest as doom or as grace, yet we tend most often to think of it as doom. Indeed, people rarely talk about fate when things go well. As Jung observes, quote, the power of fate makes itself felt unpleasantly only when everything goes against our will, when we are no longer in harmony with ourselves. In the context of counseling or psychotherapy, fate is a difficult topic to discuss. There's little or no theoretical foundation for dealing with fate in clinical work. This is perhaps a reflection of the fact that so much of Western theoretical psychology deals with cause and effect relationship, and fate doesn't lend itself well to that type of analysis. I believe that Jung is exceptional in that his psychology is not based on a cause and effect relationship paradigm, but rather he explores other principles which guide or pattern human action and the psyche. So it's not surprising that Jung is unique among psychologists in his explorations of the idea of fate in many of his writings. For example, in writing about the development of personality in his essay entitled Modern Psychology Offers a Possibility of Understanding, Jung observes the ways in which fate affects people who seem to deal well with the problems that life presents. He noticed that as new things come to people who kind of manage to do okay, when new things come either from within or from the outside, that they're met with a kind of complementary response. A new inner experience is met with an outer happening, and vice versa. And I think you can all think back on situations in your own lives when something has happened and you've been able to go with it. You've been able to just move with it, and things go well. Similarly, perhaps you've had a dream or you've had a very strong kind of unconscious upwelling in response to something that's happened to you and or that happens within you, and you make a decision to act on it, to really go with it, and it works. By contrast, I think we can all remember those times when we desperately wanted something. We wanted it so badly we could taste it. And we worked and we worked and it was thwarted repeatedly, and we continued to work at it and we never achieved it, we never got it. And often we've made ourselves miserable in the process. Sometimes it was the kind of thing that our parents told us was important, like having a job with benefits. And we had that job with benefits and then it was taken away from us. And although our talents may be prodigious in another area, we long to get that job back because that was what counted. Or that inner experience when we have the dream or we have a sense that we need to do something, and it goes against all those messages, those parental messages, and so we don't do it. And we get depressed or we get headaches or we get ulcers or something else happens. So Jung was really interested in the kind of situation. He was very impressed with the kind of situation where people could go with what happened. What impressed Jung was the sense that the response was not consciously willed, but seemed to be, quote, borne along the stream of time. There was the sense of just letting things happen, sort of I Ching kind of notion of action through non-action. Jung writes, quote, We must be able to let things happen in the psyche. Consciousness is forever interfering, helping, correcting, and negating, never leaving the psychic process to grow in peace. The challenge... Jung points to the difficulties in working toward wholeness, noting that, quote, the right way is made up, unfortunately, of fateful detours and wrong turnings. It is a longissima via, not straight, but snake-like, a path whose labyrinthine turns, twists and turns, are not lacking in terrors. And I suspect that a lot of us know that feeling as well. Given the fear involved in taking the risks to enter the labyrinth, Jung recognizes the importance of having some kind of trust in God or faith. He notes that whether sought after or not, the question of one's religious attitude towards fate enters in. According to Jung, a religious attitude has to do with a process of careful consideration. In another biblical story, one that I'm also very fond of, that of Abraham when he was ordered to sacrifice his only son Isaac, it's from the book of Genesis, Abraham's faith allowed him to proceed even in the face of this terrible command. Because of this faith, Kierkegaard called Abraham the knight of faith and was struck by the really unparalleled faith that it took for Abraham to follow this command. He calls it an unequaled faith in all the world. And I think that just as Job is an important and story for exploring our response to fate, I think Abraham, the story of Abraham and Isaac, is an important story for exploring this notion of faith, the kind of faith it takes to deal with one's fate. So I'll just conclude then with what I think in many ways is a most extreme example of accepting one's fate, and it's found in the writings of Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche's life was extremely hard. He suffered traumatic losses, including the death of his father when Nietzsche was only 4 years old. He had lifelong health problems which affected his entire body. He had migraines, digestive problems. He was, as a fairly young man, went nearly blind, and ultimately, also as a young man, went mad from incurable syphilis. All these afflictions made his life excruciating. In one of his last major works, Ecce Homo, Nietzsche looks back on his life and his development, and he writes, "My formula for greatness in a human being is amor fati." That means love your fate. He says, "My formula for greatness in a human being is amor fati, that one wants nothing to be different, not forward, not backwards, not in all eternity. Not merely to bear what is necessary, still less conceal it. All idealism is mendaciousness in the face of what is necessary, but love it." What Nietzsche writes may sound extreme, and yet I don't think it's all that far from what Jung suggests is needed if one is to enter and be born on the stream. If it's not possible to love one's fate, and sometimes it feels impossible, it seems at least necessary to remain curious and open to it. And that in itself is a pretty big challenge. So we'd like to take a break for about 15 minutes, and then we can come back about 8:45 and have some fun. About some of what I've talked about this evening, are there thoughts or Chardo?
Yeah. In a lot of writings, questions, thoughts about things, you always have God or somebody else to argue with. What about people that don't have any kind of faith at all, or faith in any kind of God, or superior being, or nasty being, and so on? How do they kind of think?
That's a good question. And I'm not the only one who need. Did everyone hear the question? Okay. Trotter was asking if you believe in some kind of supernatural being, and you believe in something like fate, you can have a kind of an argument. You can have a discussion. But what if you don't believe in anything? What if you believe that there really is nothing governing what happens in the world? What are you left with then? I see some people smiling. Go ahead.
Well, one obvious response to that is when you have a Buddhist, many Buddhists say, well, the tenets of which is accept reality.
Mm-hmm. Just accept what is. Mm-hmm. Joanne, what were you thinking about? Another possibility. But one of the things I'm wondering about is that in your question, Trottel, is this sense that often I hear people say, I don't believe in anything, and there's something else going on behind it. There's something that, whether it's a question or a fear or what it is, I don't know, and I think it's different for different people. But there's often, I've heard people say this with a lot of energy. I don't believe in anything. I don't believe in God. I don't believe there is anything controlling the universe. And so I think it's an interesting way to look at, well, if we don't believe in fate or God or anything, then these notions of it being a bunch of probabilities that unfold, or there being some pattern that simply is. I mean, there are lots of folks who puzzle over the origins of the universe, the improbability of the universe coming together of its own accord, of us all being here tonight, billions of years after something happened. Maybe it is just an issue of probability. I don't know. Yeah. Nietzsche? It just goes away in grown-ups. It's just not real popular. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that's one of the ways, that's one of the arguments or discussions about Job, that people argue that part of the reason why Job was chosen is that the only reason he was good was because he wanted to be rewarded. He wasn't good simply because he loved being good. He knew that if he was good, he would be rewarded. And in fact, he worried about his children, who tended to like to have wild parties and not observe the sacraments, and not, you know, they weren't as good as he thought they ought to be. And so there are some people who argue that the reason Job was chosen was that he was in fact not genuinely good. He was in a bargain. And then there are a number of other discussions about why he was chosen, but that's certainly one of them, which is something that, you know, that you're saying. Are there, this other stance, meaning giving over to what comes. Right. And just to go with it, which is some of what I think you were talking about that Buddhism teaches, is to go with what comes. There's not this sense, and I think it's so prevalent in this Judeo-Christian culture, of constant sort of almost unconscious bargaining. You know, if I do this, if I do that, then it will go well for me. If I'm whatever, and so there's this sort of constant calculation going on, you know, just how bad can I be before I'm going to be in trouble, and you know, or something along those lines. Whereas, you know, if you have this notion, something comes and you say, not even you don't even say, you just you go with it. You can quietly say, isn't that interesting that this should be growing in my garden today? I wonder where that came from. Instead of yanking it out like it's a weed. And it may turn out to be a weed, but it may also turn out to be a beautiful flower. Mm-hmm. It does. It really does. Precisely. Right. And that more authentic Job, and you could argue that he became more authentic as his suffering increased. That more authentic Job was these friends of his, just they were in horror. They you know, well, you must have done something bad, and not only that, but look at you now. How dare you question? Who do you think you are? And then the divorce came. So I think that's very likely, a very good point to ask about that notion of authenticity and how hard it is to be authentic. How frightening. Huh? Well, I guess what the sense that I get from Answer to Job is that what Yomi is kind of almost tracing is Job's growing awareness and capacity for questioning. Prior to these terrible things happening to him, he had it down pat. You know, if I do things this way, then I will be rewarded. If I don't do things this way, I will be punished. And then these things began to happen, and he began to question. And this what Jung calls this small but very concentrated light that goes on, is that capacity for self-reflection, which I think is some of what goes on in the Gnostics. And I'm not well versed in either Jung's Gnostic works or Gnosticism in general. I know very little bit about it, but there is this sense of reflecting and questioning that made the Gnostics very unpopular. And in that same way that Job began to question and began to explore and to come to know, and it's that sense of inner knowing, which is what Gnosticism is, that inner knowing that Job had at the end, where he was reflecting and saying, as he repeated God's own words, you know, why would God ask me this question? Why would God say, please instruct me? And this sort of growing awareness that this God is much more complicated than I thought. This God is not someone who just rewards good and punishes evil. This is a God that's unpredictable. Sometimes he rewards and sometimes he doesn't. And Job isn't the only one who knew that. King David knew that, and Abraham knew that, and many of the biblical people, figures came to know that of the Old Testament God. And so I think there, you know, in that way, I think that probably reflects Jung's Gnostic, the way in which he believed in or adhered to Gnostic principles. So I'm interested in what other people might think about that too, if other people have thoughts about that. About Jung and Gnosticism and Answer to Job, how in Answer to Job, how does that kind of square with his work in Gnosticism? I think it's a real interesting question to keep open. Some.
Yeah.
think that's a reasonable way to look at it. And he is very angry. In his book, Ion, he gives a very carefully considered attention to many of these questions about God and about Christ and about good and evil. And in answer to Job, it's a very different side of him. I'm a little hesitant about this sense of him being stuck, only because of his being able to explore Job's growing awareness of the complexity of this God. So I'm not quite convinced that Jung is stuck, but I agree with you that he's very angry, and in many ways was very much like Job at the beginning. And I think this was a very big struggle for Jung. He grew up in a family of his father was a preacher, his grandfather had been. I think he had a lot of confusion and difficult feelings about growing up in this strict Protestant family where questions weren't answered. I think those are points are very well taken. There was someone over here who had hand up. Yeah, and I think Jung would argue that also, that faith gives us things. There are sometimes things we like and sometimes things we don't like, but it certainly forces us to respond. Now, sometimes we respond by just pulling in and pulling away and, closing the curtains and locking the door and we don't go anywhere. Alternatively, we're sometimes forced to engage whatever the event is and to deal with it. And so I think you're absolutely right. And this parallel, this notion of the evolution of the God image that occurs through that he traces through Answer to Job, is I think also many people argue Jung's effort to explore the evolution or the capacity for the self to evolve, and which is what happens in this process of individuation. So I think that. It's true. Yeah. And it. Which faith? I think what Pat is asking is whether I hope I get this right. You may have to say it over again. Is sort of two levels of faith, the kind of faith that allows us to be where we are. Allows us a certain comfort with where we are and who we are, as opposed to a fate that forces us to move, we assume move upward, to evolve, to open ourselves out. And I would say that it seems to me in my own experiences that I've lived through both. That there have been times in my life when, for whatever reason, things have been kind of smooth and peaceful. I can't remember a lot of those times, but I know that there must have been some, one now and then, right? But there clearly are times when we're confronted with things that really say, what are you going to do? Are you going to be able to deal with this, or are you going to fall back on your old patterns and habits of withdrawal or whatever, work to keep you here instead of allowing you to grow. So I don't think it's either or. My sense is that we live in a dynamic of both. And how we define what is good, I believe, changes as we come to live in the grips of those things that challenge us. It's, for some reason I keep having this image of people who win the lottery. And we all have these fantasies about what would happen if we won the lottery. Wouldn't this be just the most wonderful fate? And yet, a while ago, reading in the newspaper the statistics on people who win the lottery, their lives go down the tubes. They often end up in very unhappy relationships, miserable, in jail. I don't know. I guess some have ended up in trouble with the law, but certainly that's why, when I say fate is paradoxical, and we have a tendency to think of fate as negative. I don't think it is necessarily.
Yeah.
Fate and fortune, or fate and providence. We talk about divine providence because
the term itself, fate, they have the connotation.
It does. It does.
So because we have, we have fortune, we are.
And I think Liz Green talks about that being a reflection of the early church. That thought of fate as really challenging the sovereignty of God, and so fate was a word that wasn't used. Instead, the word divine providence was used, because then things, the good things that happened, could be attributed to God, and you could attribute the rest to Satan, who was, you know, down in the netherworld. David? D-A-I-M-O-N? Sure, a little bit. It's not a thing. It's kind of a force. It's an influence that seems to function as a to push us or pull us or move us in a particular direction. And we can think of it as something which personally guides us. And it may be for the individual, or it may be for the group, but something that that's sort of the conveyor of the fate. But the distinction that I was trying to make was that much of what bothers people about this notion of fate is that that they interpret it as predestination. That I'm born, and if I'm fated, that means I have no power in my life. And the Greeks kind of, I wouldn't say they got around it, but it almost reads like that in retrospect. They saw fate much in a much broader sense as sort of something that controlled natural patterns within which people live. And it's that process of living within these patterns that the daimon functions within each of us to direct our path as we meet our fate. That's what I understand it to be. Yeah. Sure. Trilogy? Oh, it's a different one. Oh. Huh, okay. Right, yeah. And that's how it would work, right. That's excellent. Do you think that picked up? The Bread and the Bone by Robertson Davies. Thanks, David. But it doesn't. And in fact, in this wonderful essay, the quotes that I was giving you from Elie Wiesel come from an essay in a book called Messengers of God. And I found it just a few weeks ago, and I really it was just a terrific essay. And one of the things that he says about not liking the epilogue, and there are many people who argue that the epilogue was added later. In not liking it, is that he, in one part of the essay, he explores this sort of notion that even though Job was given all of these riches and children and all of this, that his insight kept him a kind of sobered and depressed man. That it was like, so what? And the difficulty, I had a little trouble reading the essay at first because there are some mutually incompatible ways in which Wiesel explores Job's these outcomes that Job had to live through, and this is one of them. He thought, well, okay, you know, if he's given all of this back, the way the Bible ends it is something to the effect that that Job lived his life to be a very old man, and died full of years. And it was in the sort of sense that was really all he had, that he really didn't want all of this given back to him. It was superfluous. So it's not the balance of getting back what you've lost, it's the more the balance of what the insight he's given you. Sure. And there are many of us who really fear things going well. Things are going too well, you know. I better watch out. Actually, I'll close with this sobering little statistic, because I know we need to leave the building by 9:30, but I recently went on a trip, and I'm not afraid of flying. I've never been particularly afraid of flying, but I always have that little moment as we're taking off or landing that I think, if it happens now, it will be very fast, and I won't know. However, my sister, who's always willing to enlighten me in the most positive way, as only sisters can, informed me just as I was just the night before that the statistics of my getting into a plane crash were the same as the statistics for my winning the lottery, about 1 in 7 million. Now, at that point, the lottery, I guess, I didn't know this, but I found out afterwards, it was up around $18 million. It subsequently went higher. Now, I didn't buy a lottery ticket, and I also didn't get into a plane crash. So, for whatever that's worth, you've been a wonderful audience, and I've really enjoyed the discussion, so I hope I'll see some of you tomorrow.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.